This week on Out of the Air features a return visit with author David Hoppe sharing his new book of haiku, Snapshot Lightning. Next, Save the Dunes Manager of Government Affairs and Policy, Harshini Ratnayaka, discussing the ongoing challenges facing the dunes. Our spotlight's at Chicago Street Theater's production of A Charlie Brown Christmas, running November 28th through December 21st.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. Like to welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight from the Chicago Street Theater. They just had two successful productions of Lizzie and A Scary Godmother they had through October. And they return again for a kind of a holiday celebration here, A Charlie Brown Christmas, November 28th through 21st. And we have the director again, Lisa Ferramoso-Perugino, and she's going to tell us all about that upcoming show. Lisa, welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thanks for having me. I'm grateful to be here.
Yeah, it's always good to see you.
Thank you. You as well. Charlie Brown Christmas is something that I actually remember sitting on the living room floor when I was a kid and watching. It's been a part of kind of my Christmas tradition for a long time. And years and years ago, I had said at Chicago Street, boy, if we could ever do a Charlie Brown Christmas, it just brings back so many great memories. And at that time, it was not even published. So I'd written to the Schultz estate and I'd asked permission to adapt it for the stage. And of course they said no. And, you know, and then 2 or 3 years later, Tams Whitmark had brought it on as a musical, because it does have some singing in
right.
it. And I was lucky enough. We did it at that time and we just had so much fun with it. It's identical to the TV series. It's timeless. It's it has a lovely message. It's fun. It's short, which is great for parents with younger kids who don't want to spend more than 45 minutes to an hour in the theater. And we have two casts. We have a cast that's comprised of teens, and then we have an adult cast. So it's going to be a lot of fun, I think.
Oh, so much fun. Is there a live band, Lisa?
There is not. We are using the canned music because the first time I did it, we did have live musicians and the music was challenging and complex, primarily for the musicians. I mean, for the singers, it really, there's only one song really that they sing. So it wasn't too complex at all. But since they have progressed with this show, there's canned music and it's beautiful, so we're just going to use that to make it
simpler.
It is
beautiful music.
It is. Hear it everywhere I go.
And it's such a timeless, like you said, it's a timeless thing. We've that's become part of tradition for Christmas for so many people, and of course the Vince Guaraldi music is just wonderful for that
and so identifiable.
It is. It's beautiful. I, you know, all of us have been spending time during the holidays and you walk in some store and you hear it and it just puts you in that mood. I love it. And Snoopy is one of my favorites and always will be one of my favorites. It's just so fun, and it's great for kids who don't know who they are. And it's a lot of fun, I think, for parents who grew up with it and just come back and see it. It's really wonderful. So I'm excited to do it and very happy that this will be the third time that we've brought it to Chicago Street.
Wow.
And do you have the two casts usually, the teen cast and the adult cast?
It depends on who I have that's interested. So the second time I directed it, I had two casts, junior high and a high school. And this year I had a lot of adults who said, why aren't you auditioning any adults? I mean, I would love to do that. And so I held auditions for adults and it was fantastic. I have enough that wanted to be a part of it and enough teens that wanted to be a part of it.
It would seem almost impossible not to want to see both of them.
I know. It is. They interpret it very differently. They approach it. I mean, the adults are really actually, they have it in their heads. So they've seen it and they know it. The teens are kind of like, I'm not sure. How does Snoopy move? And, you know, they question themselves a lot more. And the adults just dive right into it. So
I remember reading an interview with Charles Schulz, and what he was talking about, especially with Snoopy, is that Snoopy is kind of like the adult in the room. Even though he's a dog, his commentary is is almost from an adult perspective or more an older perspective than the kids. And and that's kind of an interesting thing. Have you done any other things like Good Man Charlie Brown and Snoopy?
We haven't done any of those in a while. We did them a long time ago, and now we're back in the throngs of planning for a year from now. So I don't know. I think we should look at it because the Peanuts gang is just, it's time. Everybody loves them. How could you not?
It's true. It's kind of like growing up. It's so different now because of the way movies are so readily available, but we would wait all year to see it once.
To see it once with a ton of commercials in it.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and now you can see almost anything, any of the Peanuts. There's so many that I didn't even know existed. And they're all on Apple.
Right.
Apple TV. Yeah, you can see them.
I think I have a whole set of discs of all the different Peanut things. So, you know, we at our house can watch them almost any time if we want.
That's great. I they're adorable. I mean, they're just irresistible. You can't not like them.
Well, we're coming up on our final minute. We want to give a chance to tell people how they can find out tickets for either cast, your length of run, and everything like that.
We are running from the day after Thanksgiving until the middle of December, right before the holidays begin. And you can find everything that you're looking for on our website, chicagostreet1word.org, O-R-G. There are plenty of tickets still available, but I would say if you're interested, try to get your tickets soon because this is a show that sells out quickly.
That's true. Well, that's Charlie Brown Christmas, November 28th through December 21st, chicagostreet.org. They're located at 154 West Chicago Street in Valparaiso. Or you can email the box office at boxoffice@chicagostreet.org. Lisa Formoso Perugino, thank you for coming on Art of the Air Spotlight.
Thank you both. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, thank you so much.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Emberforge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow.
This is Carmen Vincent, filmmaker and executive director of Project Neighbors, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome back David Hoppe to Art on the Air. He previously visited with us on July 7th of 2023 and on October 28th of 2022, that time alongside his talented wife, Melly. David is author of numerous books, nonfiction, fiction, poetry, plays, and a podcast. He is here to talk about his latest book, Snapshot Lightning, a book of haiku. David has been a writer, editor, and columnist for Nouveau since 1998, receiving numerous awards in a variety of categories. Thank you again for joining us. Aloha and welcome, David. Always a pleasure to see and speak with you.
Thank you very much, Esther. It's great to be here.
Well, so glad to have you back on. And we'll refer to people to our previous show if they want to hear all about your origin story like we normally do in this segment. But we just want to basically catch up on what you've been doing since we had you on the last time with Melly and everything before we get into your new work here with the haiku.
Very good. Very good. Well, I've been writing, as Esther mentioned. Just over the course of the past 2 or 3 years, I've been able to publish a couple of books. One was about Northwest Indiana, actually living in the dunes, which was called Letters from Michiana, which was written during the pandemic. And then shortly after that, I published a novel called Mondo POTUS, An American Love Story, which is a satire, which is coming to be strangely true in many ways. As time goes by, art or life continues to imitate art, I guess.
Yeah, you pick up that wave, right?
Yeah, yeah. But all of which is just to say that, you know, I guess I hate to repeat myself. And so, you know, in the past few years, I've written a memoir. I've written a series of short essays about living here in Michiana, written a novel. And the latest book is called Snapshot Lightning, as you mentioned, Esther, and it's a collection of haiku. So, you know, this is definitely a departure for me, but I'm really happy with the way it turned out.
David, do I remember you telling me that you wrote a haiku every day or maybe several?
Yes, yes, that's right. You know, I had finished working on the novel Mondo POTUS, and shortly after that, I started writing another novel, also set in the future. And that process just was not satisfying for me in some ways. I didn't want to repeat myself, and I felt like possibly I was. And so I let that novel rest for a while, and but I wanted to continue my process in terms of writing. And so I decided to write a haiku every day. And I continued doing this for a couple of years. And those are the haiku that turned into the book Snapshot Lightning.
You know, for our audience that may not know, they've heard the term haiku. Tell us about what is haiku?
Sure. Well, you know, the interesting thing about haiku is that probably most of your audience was given a chance to write them when they were in elementary school. It's a three-line poem. It comes from the Japanese. Probably the most famous haiku writer was Basho, who wrote in the 17th century. You learn how to write haiku by counting syllables. And so the classic haiku is three lines of five syllables, seven syllables, and five syllables. And that's why it becomes a really easy exercise for elementary school students. They can count the syllables. They can come away with something that resembles a poem or actually is a poem in the course of an afternoon. And you know, having said all that, as simple as that sounds, the haiku form itself turns out to be tremendously capacious. I mean, it can include an awful lot. And one of the things I found really interesting about writing haiku on a daily basis was that it also seemed to me to become a really great portal into the surreal. A lot of haiku is based upon juxtaposition. You start off in one place and you leap into another place, and just by simply juxtaposing two different lines. And that, of course, is a great way to find yourself in a surrealistic practice, too. If you think about, for instance, the collages that were done by Max Ernst, a famous surrealist artist. Those collages are based on, you know, seemingly unrelated things being put together in ways that seem dreamlike or unusual. And haiku actually has a great opportunity to, you know, allows for a great opportunity to be able to play with that kind of juxtaposition as well.
I know with the, you know, with the limited amount of words, each word takes on a great importance, the one you choose in that. I find, you know, like for me, haiku is almost a balm. It's like a puzzle, and it's like I love working within the confines of it. It's I find it really like there's such an elegant beauty to haiku.
I agree. It's very observational, and the constraints of the form really force the writer, I think, to become very precise. And so you start with observation, and then you wind up with precision, the precision of the language itself. Some would say that haiku really is not poetry per se, but it's almost a way of life. And when you practice by writing haiku every day, it puts you in a really interesting place in relationship to the rest of the world that you're in. You know, haiku doesn't allow for much abstraction. It doesn't really allow for lyricism. And so a lot of the characteristics that we assume or that we ascribe to poetry in the West don't necessarily apply in haiku. But, you know, just as I say that, I have to add that if you go back and read 17th century Japanese haiku writers, many of whom, by the way, were practicing Zen Buddhism, you find that there are a lot of different approaches to haiku. We tend to think of haiku as nature poetry, but the Japanese haiku writers really had a lot of different approaches to the form itself. They could be satirical. They could deal with nature. They could rhyme. They could pay attention to various types of formal intricacies within that three-line format. So it's a pretty interesting form and very flexible.
Yeah. With yours, as I was reading, you know, a few made me weep and a few made me brought on like that sort of Mona Lisa look, wistful. And all of it just, I was sort of obsessively turning the pages, you know.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm delighted to hear that. That's wonderful, Esther.
Do you feel like writing in haiku is kind of a cleansing process for you as an author? I know you seem to have done this over a period of time. And, you know, like you just described, you're not worrying about the lyrics of it and even like content. It's sort of by its constraints kind of as a discipline.
Well, you know, as the title suggests, snapshot, it's very observational. I find that writing haiku really tends to, you know, accentuate just my sense of being in the world. I really enjoy looking closely and finding those things that I can describe in the most concrete ways possible. And then from the concrete, you leap through juxtaposition to create a kind of tuning fork effect. You know, you want that ding that you get with a tuning fork. It's a moment of realization, a moment of resonance that, you know, I think is what I'm looking for, is what I'm after.
Well, so David, in your day then, how does that moment, you know, how does that moment come about? So do you have a day where you went by and it's like toward the end of the day and you're like, oh, you know, I wasn't inspired to write anything.
Gotta write a haiku.
I have to do it. Let me look around.
You know, I mean, If you ask my wife, she'll tell you that, you know, she could tell when I was thinking about a haiku because I'd be walking around the house, you know, just, you know, flipping fingers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 syllables, you know, in my head. You know, you just see something. And when you get in the groove, when you're writing haiku on a daily basis, which is, you know, not an onerous practice by any stretch of the imagination, when you're walking around thinking in terms of haiku, you know, you may see a leaf falling. You might, you know, see birds on your bird feeder. You might encounter somebody at a restaurant or at a train station, on the street, wherever. And suddenly you think to yourself, ah, you know, what is this that I'm looking at right now? What is this? And you start counting syllables. And before you know it, you've got a haiku.
That's so true.
It's a practice I would recommend to anybody. And what's wonderful about haiku is that it's small d democratic. Anybody can do it. And I encourage everybody to give it a try.
Yeah, we always, you know, like we're in the 10th year of the poetry showcase that the Center for Creative Solutions and I put on every year. And it's always so beautiful when the elementary students, you know, turn in haikus. They're just so charming.
Really, yeah. I think that's where most of us first came in contact with haiku. I know I did. And while, you know, nobody was, you know, teaching us about the history or the background of the form itself is just so accessible. And so ready for you right there. Everybody is experiencing the world in one way or another. And with haiku, you have a chance to try to put that into words.
Do you ever feel like you have to break the 5-7-5 rule? I mean, there's something like, oh, I have an extra syllable and it will fit perfect here. But
sure. Most definitely. And, you know, there are many Japanese haiku masters who don't follow the 5-7-5 rule at all. There's such a thing as free meter haiku, which is, you know, as the name implies, it's free meter. It's not really paying attention to syllables per se. So it's really simply focusing on the moment and trying to put that into a handy format. I set myself the rule of writing 5-7-5 just because I wanted that form as a guide. But as I began putting the manuscript for Snapshot Lightning together, I began looking at some of the haiku, and every once in a while I could see where either dropping a syllable here or adding a syllable there just made it sing just a little bit better. And so that's what I did. But most of these, the vast majority of these are in fact 5-7-5.
Well, you know, maybe this is a good opportunity to have you read some of your haiku for our audience so they can get a sense of what you've done with your new work.
Yeah, sure. I picked out a few too. We'll see if we'll hear yours and let's see if we've duplicated.
Okay, great. I'm just going to open the book at random and find one. Here it is. Skyscraper sunset. Blue clouds flowing cross bridges, mountains moving by.
And I'll do the next one for you.
Great.
Knocking down cobwebs, sunlight hanging silver threads, sticking in my hair.
Invasive species, humans are everywhere. There are no secrets.
Here's one that made me weep a little bit.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And so I hope I've done my weeping for this one, but maybe not. Let's see. Mine's bigger than yours, boy pretending to be man, wasting precious time.
They're from Chicago, still talking like they did there, asserting themselves.
Hailstone in my hand, broken ice, timeless, fresh, hurled from a cloud.
Found you sitting there with a talking hand puppet, woke up laughing.
Entering a room full of little kids dancing, needing nothing more.
Lost my keys again. Looking all over the place. Clear sky, not one cloud.
Auto dealership, playing songs from the 80s, as if I'm younger.
How about these kids, listening to our cliches, their smiling faces?
Oh, dreamboat, wonderful, sweet water licking starlight, sleep becomes morning.
Voices of workmen, finishing a weekend house, cutting down a tree.
A gull's white diving, deer leaping across our path where art wants to go.
Walking the dune trail, purple sumac seed clusters, fists full of kisses.
First there was one frog, look closer, and there were five, life clapping hands.
Trying to empty myself of all intrusions, farts, and fantasies.
They're so wonderful, David. We could spend the whole
time.
Well,
it's fun trading them with you. That's, they're like cards.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, I had a few picked out, but then I did what you were doing, and I just opened the book.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It's a little bit tricky reading haiku aloud because, they land differently than they do when you're reading them off the page, just to yourself in silence. I'm going to be doing a reading in Indianapolis on December 18th, and we're going to try something different there, and I hope to be able to bring it up here at some point. But I'm going to be reading with Andy Fry, who is a musician there. He's in a band called Stray Sparks. And Andy designed the book, Snapshot Lightning. He's a collaborator with me. He's really designed my last three books. And he also was the sound designer on my podcast, The Jefferson Airplane Still Matters. But Andy is going to accompany the reading with electric guitar. So, I'm hoping that the electric guitar will create a kind of space within which the reading of the haiku can take place.
Yeah, almost like a singing bowl in a sense.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a good comparison.
So was he the one that decided the minimalist approach with the poems? Like sometimes there's just one poem to a page, maybe two.
Actually, we were both inspired by a book of free meter haiku by a Japanese writer called Ipkiro that I have in my library here at home. And in that book, which also, by the way, was basically a square shaped book, those haiku there were never more than two per page. And I really liked that layout. So when I brought Andy the manuscript, I brought the manuscript pretty much as it turns out in the book itself, which was just, scattering the haiku, giving them plenty of space on the page, using a lot, making the most of white space.
So I have a question about Andy really quick. So before you started doing this, had he written haiku before? Because he, he's got a little bit of haiku at the end of the book.
Oh, at the very, yeah. No, he had not. And that's just kind of a little fun afterthought. After he had designed the book, he designed it with my biography written in haiku.
Yeah, it's great.
And he did it basically as a joke, but I loved it and decided, it's in the spirit of the book itself and we should include it. So we did.
I'm so glad you did.
Oh, good. Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that because I get a big kick out of it.
In our last couple of minutes here, we want to give you an opportunity to talk about things you have, maybe projects that are on the horizon that are working.
Sure. Well, I've gone back to that novel I talked about earlier. It's a novel set in the future. It's about two designers who are creating a virtual beach in the city of Indianapolis. So that's going to take a while. I'm about 10,000 words into it. So there's about 60,000 more to go. I don't have a title for it yet. But that's basically occupying my time right now. Andy and I did this podcast called The Jefferson Airplane Still Matters, and you can find it, by Googling the title, The Jefferson Airplane Still Matters. It's free, and, you can download it, if you want to listen to it. I'm really pleased with the way it turned out. The sound design by Andy Fry is incredible. And, it's a story as much about what's going on in America today as it is about the Jefferson airplane in the 60s. So highly recommended. I'm looking to set up readings of Snapshot Lightning in the near future. So that's about what I've got going on right now.
Fantastic. And any, you have one in December coming up. Was that Indianapolis, you said, with the...
Yeah, that's in Indianapolis. Okay. At the Brian Payne Theater, which is part of the Indie Fringe headquarters in Indianapolis on Massachusetts Avenue. That's December 18th. It's going to be, I believe, at 6 o'clock in the evening. But if you want to get down to Indy on December 18th, I'll be there. And so will Andy. And, hopefully it'll be an interesting performance.
And maybe you should do, maybe we could plan to have something locally. That would be kind of great for you to share since you're up here in Duneland. And
I'm looking for venues and, and we'll do the guitar reading up here as well.
Oh, so, great. Hopefully I'll be open and we can talk.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, we'll see. And look for TikTok, too. We're going to do, Andy and I are going to try and, take Haiku onto TikTok. So we'll see how that goes.
Oh, excellent.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air, or returning to us with Snapshot Lightning, and it's available on Amazon and all other booksellers. And we appreciate coming on and sharing your Haiku and your Haiku journey with our audience. And, of course, Esther and both of you reading. Thanks so much, David, for coming back on the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, it's always so delightful to talk to you, David.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Ken Hunley, and you're listening to Art on the Air from Lakeshore Public Media at 89.1 FM and WVLP at 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Harshini Ratnayatka to Art on the Air. Harshini is the Manager of Government Affairs and Policy for Save the Dunes. She grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana, and holds a Bachelor of Science in Biology and a JD in Comparative Law. She was also a legal intern for Louisiana Sea Grant, where she worked on environmental policy and projects, always combining her love for protecting the environment with helping others in her community. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. It is so wonderful seeing you, Harshini.
Yeah, no, thank you so much, Esther. I really appreciate it. Hi, everyone. My name is Harshini. As Esther mentioned, I'm currently the policy contact here at Save the Dunes. So thanks for having me on.
We appreciate you coming on the show. Like with all of our guests, we always want to know your origin story. I always like to tee it up by saying how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about yourself.
Sounds good. So as I mentioned, my name is Harshini. I am currently living in Michigan City, Indiana, and happy to work out of the Barker House. That's where the Save the Dunes offices are. But originally, I actually was born in New York, Bronx section of New York, for the people who are from that region. I'm a Bronx girl. Was born there in the 94 in January, and basically moved around the U.S., because of my parents. So they are both originally from Sri Lanka. That's a country and an island that's basically south of India, but in the Indian Ocean area. They came here to do their graduate studies. So both of them are scientists. They did their PhDs in the City University of New York, and then moved around to do their postdoc, which is something that you do after you get a PhD, some research. So moved from New York when I was 6 to New Mexico, stayed there for 3 years during my dad's postdoc completion, and then eventually moved to New Orleans and did most of my childhood, went to most of my schooling in New Orleans from ages of about 12 to since now when I moved up here and worked for Save the Dunes, which was about now 4 years ago. So during that time in New Orleans, it was great. It was a little different from up here in Indiana. The easiest contrast from this area is that there were not really four seasons. So I was happy to come up here and experience that. But while I was there, I was really interested in environmental issues, especially with having two scientists as parents. Kind of came naturally. That was something we talked about a lot of times around the dinner table. My parents, especially my dad, is into environmental sciences. He's currently a professor at Xavier University of Louisiana. So teaching biodiversity and ecology is something that he does. So we have many a conversation about plants and the ecosystem, erosion issues, what have you. Kind of a comparison to Northwest Indiana is, of course, coastal erosion or shoreline erosion. That's something that not only do we talk about at Save the Dunes, but also we, you know, have an issue with that, of course, in the coastal Louisiana area. So that was always something that was really interesting and kind of topical and very similar to what we have to experience here in Northwest Indiana. So from that experience, it was, you know, very different, of course, living in New Orleans, Louisiana, if you've ever been there. I mean, it's a lot of culture and food and, you know, a lot of partying, which was great. You know, when you're growing up, there's a lot of really, really awesome events. So if you are listening and you're like, I've never been to New Orleans, I highly recommend it, especially it's a good family time down there, particularly. I know everyone likes the parade, so Mardi Gras is a great time to go down there. But I would say that really kind of shaped how I understand environmental issues. So went there for undergrad, went to Xavier University of Louisiana. And when I graduated with my undergraduate in biology, I really was interested in how to intersect both my biology degree with more real life and real world issues. And so I attended LSU law in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, which is about like an hour north of New Orleans, and then did my JD there. And then unfortunately, when I graduated, we were the class of 2019. So COVID hit. And so nobody was really hiring for any kind of environmental nonprofit jobs at that time. You know, as everyone knows, that was kind of a trying time, especially if you were graduating and trying to get your first job. So had to do a couple of odd jobs. Ironically, worked for the airport. So that was an interesting time. It was actually kind of great, but did that for about 2 years. And then Save the Dunes had a opening for an advocacy coordinator at that time. And so I applied and I was grateful enough to get the job and then moved up here about four years ago. So I've been here ever since and hopefully am contributing to the Northwest Indiana region and hope to talk about that a little bit today.
So I want to take you back to elementary school. So were you naturally, so being in this very science household, I can imagine, of course, you were just very interested in science, but did you gravitate toward anything else? And did the school system support a huge science interest for you? I mean, were they?
Yeah, I would say elementary is like a hard thing for me to remember. But I would say once I moved to New Orleans, yes, for the most part, I would say it's the Louisiana school system is quite trying and different. I would say that from a schooling perspective, yes. So there, I'm not sure if this is something that's in Northwest Indiana, but there's something called a magnet school system that yes. We have in New. Okay, so that was so just for people who don't know, so that was something where if you took a test and you passed it, you were able to go into like a special school called a magnet school, which were basically for gifted or talented kids. That was definitely still a public school. We did not pay a single cent to go there. This is mostly for very kind of smart and talented kids who maybe don't come from backgrounds or families who have a lot of money who can actually afford putting their kids into private schools, but would like to see their kids kind of do well in a interesting environment. So yeah, I was able to go there, and I would say there really, especially at the magnet schools, we had a lot of teachers who left the public school system for the, I guess you would call them the normal public school system, and went specifically to go teach at these magnet schools because they wanted to teach kids who were there to learn and like enjoyed learning, wanted to learn more. So I would say absolutely we had a biology teacher there that was really amazing. She really, you know, went above and beyond what they what she needed to do, and really kind of got my interest piqued in biology. But I would mostly say it was my parents. I would say for sure they were the ones who kind of steered me in that direction, but also were able to kind of answer any questions I had about anything related to the environment or, you know, erosion issues, especially. I mean, we have a lot of interesting things that happen environmentally in the New Orleans area. So definitely did help me kind of understand what my place could be in the environmental world. Now, both of them are really science people, so they are not really environmental policy related or environmental law related at all. So that was kind of my breakout, I guess, from the norm of the family was that, because my brother is also a science background. He has a PhD in chemistry. So I'm kind of the weird odd duck, but
It sounds like so fabulous to be surrounded by that family.
You know, it's great. You definitely feel a little bit inferior next to these amazing scientists with all their PhDs, but it's great. It's amazing because you get to, you know, I get to say that they're part of my family.
My question is, of course, you go from biology to law, and partially maybe that's because the exposure to where you were living, but you know, tell us about that bridge. I mean, here you, again, you just said you're surrounded by PhDs, and, you know, a JD is nothing to sneeze at either. So, I mean, it's actually a doctor too. It's a juris doctor. But tell us about that connection there between law and biology.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you again. No, I appreciate it. Definitely a different pathway from the biology background. So I would say because of what we see online and also in the news, this is something that I was really interested in. I mean, every time you turn on the news and it's an environmental issue, it's usually about a natural disaster or something happening with the federal government or an agency rule or a Supreme Court case or something like that. So I was always just very interested in that. I thought that was a very interesting place to kind of connect the hard sciences, the biologies, the chemistries, the environmental sciences to real world issues and real life issues that actually affect everyday Americans. So, you know, when we were talking at Save the Dunes about shoreline erosion, we're not talking about it in a kind of textbook way or a way that is very, I guess, does not affect people. It literally affects all of our shoreline communities, including anybody in Northwest Indiana. When we talk about wetlands, we're not talking about it from a very definition perspective. We're talking about it as, hey, next time that your house is in a place where it might have more flooding, this is something that would affect you because wetlands can keep more than 1.5 million gallons of water. And so it'll reduce the flooding risk to your house. So I think that connection to real world issues and real life issues, and also the fact that it is basically a current event all the time. Environmental issues keep coming up, as we know, in Northwest Indiana very specifically. I mean, we at Save the Dunes directly now work with the National Park as an official partner. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that happen in Northwest Indiana, particularly with our different and unique environments that really do affect Northwest Indiana residents like every single day. So I think that connection was something that I was drawn to. I think environmental policy, especially right now, is something that is always changing and always interesting. So I'm really happy to kind of be in this specter.
And then that brings me to my point. I wanted to ask you about, under the current administration, there's huge changes in like EPA law and things like that, and how that impacts an organization like Save the Dunes, the parks and everything, cutbacks that may be impacting you. So maybe you can speak to that. And then we'll get on, I know, one way of what your day-to-day job is. But since you went to the policy question, I thought I would go there.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say the current 2025 administration has seen a lot. We've seen a lot of changes, particularly to our national parks. So just in this year of 2025, we've lost about 24% of the National Park Service staff across the board, which is unfortunate. This is something that you will know as a Northwest Indiana resident, but of course our Indiana Dunes National Park is the number one tourist destination in the entire state of Indiana. We get about 2.6 million visitors every single year. During our peak times, which was during COVID, we had more than 3.1 million visitors. So this obviously is a huge, huge asset, both economically, but also for the environmental lovers here. There are more than 10 different types of ecosystems in our national park. So obviously a big asset from an economic and environmental perspective. So with all of the changes from the administration, it unfortunately put a damper on the staffing. So we had about 180 full and part-time staff who work at the Indiana Dunes National Park. And unfortunately, with some of the reductions in staffing over the last couple of months, we've seen that number dwindle. And so how does that actually affect our park is that the resources, especially the natural resources team, is unfortunately affected and cannot do a lot of invasive species management or habitat restoration that makes sure that our park is looking as beautiful as it can, especially for the visitorship when people are coming in during the summer and fall, which is when our peak seasons are, when we have the most visitors come to our national park. We want to make sure that they have a good experience, a good visitorship experience, and then tell others to come to Northwest Indiana and explain why it's such an important reason to visit our national park in particular. So from that perspective, it's been really trying. I know that we've done a couple of call to actions about it on our website if anyone's interested, about just making sure that we get these really important bills, and we can go into it later, but one of the big important bills that helps the national park is the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. So just making sure that that's fully funded so that the park can do what they do every day, which is protect the natural resources, greet visitors when they come into the park, explain why Northwest Indiana is so amazing. And so unfortunately, with some of the staffing cuts, it's really put a damper on our staffing for the National Park Service.
So I'm interested, what is your day-to-day job like? Tell us, like, maybe routine or maybe it's not so routine.
It's a great question. I would say usually it's pretty routine. Now it's kind of reflective of what's been going on in the federal government. It's kind of all over the place. So
I would say on your desk currently, what are you working on right now?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's quite interesting. So I would say for the most part, it's a lot of figuring out what's going to happen with the park. Unfortunately, there have been a couple of rumors about maybe having another reduction or something of that sort. So really just making sure that we do anything that we can to support the park. Of course, right now, during the government shutdown, there's a lot of confusion about, you know, how the staff are doing. We obviously have not had them come back because the park is technically open, but none of them are actually working right now until the government shutdown is until the government is open and the government shutdown ends.
I haven't heard any awful stories about the Indiana National Park, though, like other national parks around the country have experienced lots of vandalism and things during the shutdown.
Yeah, I think that's something that we were kind of excited about, actually. So there's a Facebook group where it's a lot of the Indiana National Park partners and supporters who are going to the different areas of the national park and just checking on them during the government shutdown. And so I've been doing that too, particularly since I live in Michigan City. Mount Baldy is right down the road. It's about a 5-minute drive. So I've been going there just to make sure that there's not been any kind of shenanigans or littering or anything that we should be aware of. And it's really been pretty amazing. I was very, very surprised. I mean, I haven't seen that many pieces of trash in the parking lots or any really bad bathrooms. I mean, I think the custodial staff, you know, are doing an amazing job as well during the shutdown. And I think people are just aware and maybe are being a little bit more diligent when they are visiting the park. So I don't know if it's just because we're from the Midwest. Maybe we can say that just because people from the Midwest maybe are just like nicer. I mean, I agree. That's kind of why I feel a little bit more at home here from the South. I'm just like, oh, the Midwest, everyone's so nice. So maybe that's what it is. And so we are one of the only Midwest parks. That could be it. But absolutely. I know that we've talked to some of our friends in, I know Yosemite, for instance, and they were talking about just like pure chaos, people just parking wherever they want in the gate entrances and people just blocking the road sometimes and trash everywhere. So fortunately, we've, I think, had a great community who understands how important it is to take care of our park. This is our backyard. This is something that really defines us as a region and something that we should be proud of. And I think everybody's been stepping up. So if you've been doing that as well, if anybody who's listening has been going to the park and cleaning up or picking up trash, we, you know, thank you and keep it up. We'll keep doing it. We'll keep doing beach cleanups and we'll keep supporting the park. So
I think it's a natural habit of this area. You know, when I go for hikes, everybody else is also carrying around their bag to pick up whatever happens to be on the beach or on the trail. So I think it's just an ingrained habit. So the thing that, of course, concerns me the most is clean water. Is, you know, that's one of your areas as well, especially after, you know, the occasional or maybe the occasional spill that happens. So after that spill in 2019, is it still mandated that water is checked regularly?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. Thank you, Esther. So I know you mentioned 2019, but I actually want to bring us a little bit back, a couple of years before that. So we saw a 2017 spill, actually, that was the hexavalent chromium spill from U.S. Steel Midwest, which unfortunately hexavalent chromium is a carcinogen, so it causes cancer. And so that happened in 2017, and then the spill that you're talking about happened in 2019. That was from ArcelorMittal, which is now Cleveland Cliffs, and that saw more than 3,000 fish kill that was directly on Lake Michigan and affected the park and all the other communities on the lakeshore. So that happened, and then there was also a 2020 iron discoloration from U.S. Steel Midwest. So yeah, there's definitely been a couple of really bad pollution events in the past. I would say for the most part, overall, most of the industries are now, at least their permits are being followed for the most part. I know there's a lot of issues and events that are happening that they will go above their permitting levels. And of course, we condone them for that. We don't want to have anybody, especially the facilities on our lakeshore, do that. But what I would say is, for the most part, overall, it seems like they are understanding that to be a good neighbor, to stay in this community, you need to be a good neighbor. You need to actually follow your permits. You need to tell people what's been going on. And so that's definitely an uphill battle, something we're still struggling with, especially from an environmental nonprofit perspective. We understand that, you know, it's very tricky, right? Because we are proud to be a steel region. We are a steel community. We have people who are from the steel industry family. They are steel strong, sometimes they say. And so that's great. That's something to be proud of. But also at the same time, we can protect our families. We can make sure that we can get the food on the table, but also protect the environment that we live in. So definitely keeping up that balance, making sure that we're safe and people are following their permits is something that we still focus on every single day. So we'll continue to do that in the future. But overall, I would say that especially I would just shout out to Cleveland Cliffs. They are being, very diligent. Good partners in that way. Communication with the community as well has been improved. And so that's something that we like to see. So hopefully they keep it up, and we're here to help support the water pollution prevention events.
Right, because that also ties in with the public trust that you work with, too, keeping the beaches free and open to everybody, which is so important.
There's other organizations like Save the Dunes, like Dig the Dunes. And so do you coordinate with them? And also let our audience know maybe how they can get involved. You kind of touched on that, but the reach out to different organizations. But how do you coordinate with those other organizations to do things collectively, and then also how people get involved?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, so Eve on I think she's the founder basically of Dig the Dunes, is actually on our, I think it's our development committee. So she helps us a lot with our fundraising event. So we just had it in Washington Park, or Millennium Park, which was the Jammin' event. So that was just a fundraiser to help support our organization's efforts and all of our programs and things that we stand for. So she helps us in that way. A lot of the partners that I work with, of course, are in the policy sector. So just National Park Conservation Association, Conservation Law Center. And then a lot of the other partners really are the conservation partners. So, of course, the park, we directly work with the park. We are now an official partner with the National Park in a philanthropic partnership with them. We also have Shirley Hines Land Trust, who owns a lot of the nature preserves in Northwest Indiana. So we work directly with them on a lot of their conservation efforts. And also like TNC, so Nature Conservancy or TNC, in the region, Audubon Great Lakes. So there's a lot of different conservation partners that we work with. I would say that most of our work in conservation is about, of course, invasive species management and habitat restoration in the park. And I would say if anybody is interested in getting involved, if you want to just check out our website, we have a lot of interesting educational materials and resources. But now, because of the government shutdown, what we're really just saying is anything you can do to support the park itself is great. So if it's going, and as Esther mentioned, just going with a bag and maybe just doing a couple of beach cleanups by yourself or with your family when you're going to visit the park, that's a great way to get involved. Maybe if you go and you happen upon a custodial staff while they're cleaning up the park, maybe just telling them thank you, because you know they are really feeling, unfortunately, the issues and the raft of just not being able to work right now during the government shutdown. So anything you can do to support the park would be great. We do have an event coming up, but as Esther mentioned, I think it is full, but I just wanted to shout out anyway. We do have an arts pressed flower mindfulness journal workshop that's going to be at our offices at Barker House. It's on this December the 13th at 12 to 3. And we are partnering with Lubesnik Art Center to do this. So we're going to have a pressed flower journal that people are going to be able to make themselves, and also a mindfulness session. So, you know, just FYI of just, we do a lot of different events. That's just one of them. I know we have also a lot of quarterly educational webinars or sessions or workshops. So if there's a issue or an environmental topic that anyone is interested in and you would like to know more information about it, just let me know. You can email me at Harshini, H-A-R-S-H-I-N-I at savedunes.org, or you can just go on our website and all the information will be there about our organization and what we do.
We appreciate you coming on and sharing everything. That's Harshini. She's the Manager of Government and Affairs Policy for Save the Dunes at savethedunes.org. Thanks for coming on the show and sharing so much about what you do.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited that I was able to be here.
We so appreciate it. Thank you.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, Thoughtful Marketing and Digital Learning, built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts, arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.